Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, former President Jimmy Carter has died at the age of 100. We'll recall a visit he made to Jacksonville, Illinois, a decade ago. A new tool can help the public view the employment history of police officers. With the threat of mass deportations, a lot of attention is being placed on sanctuary cities. Illinois has some. What are they, and what are their limitations? We'll discuss age bias in the workforce and find out how some rural areas are dealing with homelessness. Also, the rise of women's sports has resulted in a spinoff, women's sports bars. Those stories and more coming up this hour here on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. You've probably heard the term sanctuary city. It means local law enforcement can't collaborate with federal immigration officials when they try to enforce immigration laws, including deportations. Chicago and some other towns in the state have similar policies, but there are limitations. Immigration reporter Adriana Cardona-McGeegan talked with Mary Dixon about what sanctuary laws actually do and what they don't.
So how do sanctuary laws actually protect undocumented people?
So there are two main ways in which this works: information and manpower. First, local law enforcement can't collaborate with ICE agents looking to deport people, especially when they ask local authorities in jails and prisons, for example, to hold individuals at ICE's request or even notify them or give them names. Also, city officials and police are generally not allowed to ask about people's immigration status during routine interactions. The second one is manpower. They can't transport non-citizens or secure an area so that ICE can do checkpoints. I spoke with Mark Fleming with the National Immigration Justice Center, and he put it in context.
It is the responsibility of the federal government to do that enforcement. And when you add in state and local law enforcement, it really force multiplies. ICE has about 20,000 agents. If you add in cooperation from state and local law enforcement, that's 800,000 other law enforcement agents.
What is the argument for having these policies on the books?
Illinois has nearly a half million undocumented immigrants, plus thousands of recently arrived migrants. And a lot of these people live in mixed status homes and are integrated into our communities. I talked to a lot of people out there on the field, and a lot of these undocumented residents, they want a path to legal status in the country, but because they enter the country legally, there's really not a lot of options for them. So these sanctuary laws help protect undocumented immigrants from being criminalized or targeted by local police. Also, it really builds relations between police and immigrant communities.
There are limits to what sanctuary laws can do, though. Can you walk us through them?
Yeah, there is one big limit here. City and state officials can't prevent ICE agents from enforcing federal immigration law on their own. ICE agents could bypass these and rely on intimidating strategies like illegal traffic stops, and those are tactics they tried in the past.
President-elect Trump has promised mass deportations on day one of his new administration. Would Chicago and Illinois sanctuary laws help to protect against that?
Under these local laws, ICE enforcement efforts can be limited, but again, not entirely prevented. We don't know how massive these deportation efforts can be because of a lack of manpower at the federal level, but Trump recently confirmed plans to declare a national emergency and use the U.S. military to assist with mass deportations. And to do that, he could invoke the Insurrection Act, which gives the president emergency powers to use federal troops on domestic soil to curb local unrest. But it'll get challenged in court. It's also worth noting that Trump has threatened to punish sanctuary cities by removing federal funding, something he unsuccessfully tried to do in Chicago during his first presidency.
Adriana Cardona-McGeegan covers immigration for WBEZ. Thanks, Adriana.
Thank you, Mary.
The nonprofit journalism organization Invisible Institute last year launched a new tool allowing people to look up employment history of police officers. The tool comes after the death of Sonia Massey, who was shot and killed by a now former Sangamon County Sheriff's Deputy, Sean Grayson. Records had showed Grayson had misconduct issues at departments before working for Sangamon County. Kim Schofield talked with Sam Stecklow about the tool.
Sam, tell us more about the motivation for creating this new tool.
So this kind of information has been something that Invisible Institute has been interested in since we launched our Civic Police Data Project in Chicago in 2015 and 2016. And that is a database that shows police misconduct, use of force, and other data for the Chicago Police Department. And we knew pretty quickly that obviously, police misconduct does not end at city limits. And so we began asking questions about what other data outside of the city of Chicago can we get? Of course, we can get data and records from individual police departments like the Chicago Police Department, but there's also this entity called the Illinois Law Enforcement Training and Standards Board that is responsible for overseeing the certification of all police officers in Illinois, and they actually track police employment changes and the reported reason for those employment changes, such as an officer resigned, retired, was terminated. And so that's data that we began to collect in states across the country, and we were able to launch this tool, the National Police Index.
Where does the information provided on the National Police Index come from?
Yeah, so every single state has a Police Officer Standards and Training Board. They're usually called POSTs in Illinois. It's the Law Enforcement Training and Standards Board, except for one state has some kind of entity like this. And these bodies are responsible for issuing certifications, or sometimes they're called licenses to police officers. And many states also have the ability to strip these certifications of police officers, but it's usually a very high bar in Illinois. Until the Safety Act passed, it was being convicted of a felony or several specific misdemeanors. And so the data really shows how many officers are able to transfer between departments and transfer after being terminated.
Illinois has had a similar officer lookup tool that allows users to see which departments an officer has worked for. What makes this new tool different?
Yeah, so this new tool that the Law Enforcement Training and Standards Board launched sometime last year allows users to search the name of an officer. And so this is what allowed a lot of reporting, early reporting about Sean Grayson having worked for six police departments in just a few years. But it requires knowledge of the name of the officer, and it does not show the reason why an officer left an agency. Our tool allows for filtering and browsing by agency as well as officer, or simply date or the reason for separation. There's all sorts of ways that you can utilize the data. You can download the data. And then the reason for separation is also a very useful point. Now, I'll say it is only as accurate as the department reporting it to the state. And so we recently had reporting about Sean Grayson's departure from the Kincaid Police Department, where the police chief reported that it was only related to him not wanting to live within a certain, you know, radius of the village. And we know that around that same time, there was issues with evidence in a criminal case that Grayson had brought in that village. And it's potential that there's the potential that his departure was not just related to him not living within a certain radius of the village. So it's only as accurate as the departments who are reporting up to the state. But even that question is something that is interesting and worth digging into. But just the caveat that our data comes directly from the state. We don't do anything except some very light cleaning and processing. And so all of the information is simply what the state provides to us and what they receive from police departments.
Sam, is there anything else that you would like to add?
Just that we encourage folks to reach out to us with any questions, to access the data themselves, look up their own city, their own town, police officers who they know of, and to let us know if there's other information or other questions that we should be asking.
Sam Stecklow is an editor and reporter with Invisible Institute, a nonprofit journalism organization. Sam, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
The death of former President Jimmy Carter has led many to reflect on his time in office and his post-presidency. In 2014, Carter received an honorary degree from Illinois College in Jacksonville. He visited the campus for a panel discussing how to achieve peace in the Middle East. Jenna Dooley talked with Illinois College President Barbara Farley, who was with Carter that day.
President Farley, upon the recommendation of the faculty and with the authorization of the trustees of Illinois College, I have the honor of presenting President Jimmy Carter to you for the degree of Doctor of Humane Letters.
Most people think, of course, of Georgia when they think of Jimmy Carter, but he does have some ties to Illinois. It was October 2014 when he was invited to your campus in central Illinois. Can you tell me how that visit came together?
There are a couple of connecting dots. One is Congressman Paul Findley, who represented his district in Illinois for a very, very long time and lived in Jacksonville. He was a great friend of Khalaf Al-Habtour, who is in the UAE in Dubai. And Dr. Al-Habtour received an honorary degree from Illinois College. He was a benefactor of ours, and he invited President Carter to come to campus. They had been doing some work together related to the Carter Center, Dr. Al-Habtour and President Carter.
And you accompanied the former president during his stops that day. What did he see while he was in Illinois on that visit?
He saw our new archives, the Al-Habtour archives, which had just been dedicated the night before. And he got a tour of the archives from one of our history professors. He also met with students from the Phi Alpha Literary Society in the Paul Findley Congressional Office Museum on campus. He had lunch at the president's residence. We hosted a lunch for about 10 people, and I have just terrific memories of that. And then he gave a lecture. It was the Phi Alpha lecture focused on peace in the world, specifically peace in the Middle East. So that was the day. He was only here for about 6 or 7 hours, but we did a lot. We crammed a lot into that time.
What do you remember about his comments that day?
He began his lecture by talking about his commitments to peace around the world, what he had accomplished as president, and what he had really dedicated his life to in his post-presidency, specifically the decision to establish the Carter Center and his travels around the world. He told us that day he had been in over 160 different countries, and he really framed out how important it was to focus on human rights and peace throughout the world, democratic systems. He talked about the work that he had done to oversee elections in his post-presidency. And then he shifted to talk about his newest book, which was his 28th book. And it had just come out. It's called A Call to Action, Women, Religion, Violence, and Power. And so he talked about the Carter Center's focus on really difficult situations, violent situations for women and girls around the world. And we talked about that, and then he wove in his hopes for peace in the Middle East.
We feel that there must be an end to the war in the Middle East. And I think my dream has been, for now for 35 years, is to bring peace to Israel. And it's a way to bring peace to Israel without having peace and justice for their neighbors, the Palestinians. We're still working on that, and we'll continue to do that.
And given the events of this last year, it's really sobering to listen to what he had to say 10 years ago in terms of his aspirations for a two-state solution and so forth. So I look back on that period as being with a man who had done so much already, and little did we know another 10 years ahead for him. What I loved about that day is that we had Illinois College students, of course, who were there, and we had students from middle schools and high schools around the area. Buses appeared. We had to turn people away at the door because we had such a great crowd.
What do you remember about just the sheer logistics of bringing a former president to a small college in a largely rural part of the state?
We were very fortunate. We had at the time a campus events director who had worked for the NCAA, and she was used to big events. And she worked with the Secret Service to get everything lined up. There were very specific things, as you can imagine, that had to happen. He had a Secret Service detail with him that I would say was probably 4 or 5 people. Everybody who was going to meet him and be in close proximity to him had to go through a background check. And so it was very clear there were rules. But at the same time, they were sort of in the background and they did not make themselves very well known. And I had this moment at the president's residence after lunch. President Carter took a break because the next thing was going to be the lecture. And the Secret Service, you know, moved outside the door of the room where he was taking a rest. And I walked by and needed to get something. And the Secret Service member said, I said, I'm sorry, maybe I shouldn't be here. And she said, ma'am, this is your house. And so it was just, it was really wild. The lasting memory is that so many young people were able to hear from this former president. He was president before they were born. He's somebody in the history books. And I think that the fact that our students at Illinois College and students from around the area came together to be exposed to his ideas and his thoughts that day, and that his visit lingers on in the memory of Illinois College, was very special. And certainly personally, it was an amazing day, and I honor him, and we are mourning President Carter's passing. We will be remembering him as he is honored across the country.
Jenna Dooley talking with Illinois College President Barbara Farley about former President Jimmy Carter's visit to Jacksonville, Illinois in 2014. Coming up, we'll talk about ageism in the workforce. That and more ahead on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Do older individuals face bias when it comes to getting a job? Stacy Haller is Chief Career Advisor for ResumeBuilder.com. The online service surveyed 1,000 hiring managers and found age bias exists for the most senior applicants and their counterparts in Generation Z. Maureen McKinney talked with her.
Your survey showed that 4 in 10 hiring managers have an age bias against Gen Z, and 1/3 admit to age bias against senior candidates. So which is really worse if you're trying to get a job?
I think what's worse is what we're seeing is everybody's having a bias against somebody in this hiring process. These numbers that you just shared, when I looked underneath it, it turns out that 63% of our respondents were between the ages of 25 and 44. So it looks like that cohort group is not hiring people younger than them or older than them. And that's really interesting. And this cohort are the folks that are first getting into management. So when I read this and I'm like, okay, so now we have the first year's early folks in their management career having a bias against the Gen Z. And we know there has been bias against Gen Z because they entered the workforce with skills that were not sharpened due to remote work. And since they started remote, when they got into the workforce, we've had many surveys, and you could read a lot on the internet about why folks are not interested in hiring Gen Zers, because they don't have the skills and organizations have not been prepared on how to train them and onboard them, understanding that. And we know there's been bias against older workers always. So when you say which is worse, I think they're both pretty bad. And I don't think age should ever be a requisite in terms of a requirement for anybody getting hired.
Isn't it true that there are laws against age discrimination?
Absolutely. 100% age discrimination is illegal. And some people have brought some cases up. Many times, though, you don't even know you're being age discriminated against, or you wouldn't know. It might not be obvious. You could be sending out many resumes and not getting called. Now, you might assume at some point it's age, but it's never in a place where you could actually prove it or have a case. So it is very difficult in that regard. And as hard as that is, it's very easy for people to discriminate about age, because we have seen from some of our other surveys that if a hiring manager really wants to know how old you are, they'll resort to looking up on Facebook or looking other ways to see if they could determine. So yes, it's 100% illegal everywhere. That doesn't mean it doesn't happen.
The 1 in 3 said that elderly appearance is something that they'll use against a candidate.
Well, of course, my first reaction is it's amazing that people even admit to these things, honestly. And we've had other surveys just in general about how hiring managers feel about appearance, whether it might be somebody who is very overweight or very tall. And those appearance biases we know exist as well. Now, our survey that you're referring to, we did focus on senior candidates. If you're biased against older workers and you're doing a Zoom interview with someone and they appear elderly to you, or they're even showing, sometimes even not knowing the technology, that is not only relegated to seniors, by the way, but it does happen. And yes, that's all illegal too.
I'd imagine years of job experience would flag you as being older. Why does having an address listed, why does that flag you as older?
Because people don't mail you anything anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing is done by mail. And there's another very good reason. It's another reason for bias. People mm-hmm. will judge you where you live. It's totally irrelevant. Nobody's mailing you anything. Nobody needs to know where you live. So we started eliminating street addresses off of resumes over a decade ago for those very two reasons. Just like a picture is not appropriate on a resume either. It just fuels bias, and it's irrelevant as to whether or not you could be a great employee.
What does that mean for the person looking for a job?
And that really is the key, you know, for seniors, let's say, who are looking for work. And many of them, there's no retirement age anymore. There are more seniors that if they want to work, they have more opportunities, especially due to remote work. But it's important about how you go about that search, knowing that there is age discrimination out there. So that includes everything from on your resume, having an AOL address flags you as an older person. Having things like your street address on your resume, that no longer belongs there. And that also positions you as someone older. So just what's on your resume might indicate you're not current today. So it's very important on how a resume is structured. Graduation dates, no longer necessary. There's no reason that you need to have the date of your college degree or when you graduated. Just the fact that you have a degree. So those are some things that could eliminate some age bias. And then, of course, these folks need to stay up on top of the technology, show energy, show they're willing to learn, fight against what we know the biases are. And the younger generation, to fight their biases, they have to acknowledge that there's some skills that they will need going forward. And understanding how the process works a little bit better. So knowledge will help all the generations get through some of this bias as we kind of chip away, because clearly it's not helpful to anyone. And the more I see these surveys, I'm wondering who doesn't have a bias against them.
Who doesn't? Who is least likely to suffer from hiring managers' bias?
When I look at this survey and I see that the people who tend to feel this way and are carrying these biases are the, let's say, the late 20s to the mid 40-year-old managers, it looks to me like they're only hiring themselves then if they have biases on folks older or younger than them. But we also know within this group that there are other biases. People have race biases, sex biases. So it does make me wonder, with the proliferation of biases And then the backlash to that was building diversity within organizations and paying attention to this. And unfortunately, the news later says sometimes we're moving away from it. So everybody needs to pay attention and focus on why we hire workers. It really is contingent on their skills, their experience, their ability to do the jobs, and factors that have no place in the hiring process just needs to be eliminated. I really think the importance is bringing this to everyone's attention. I think it's in some ways encouraging that we're talking about it so we could pay attention to it and work to eliminate it, where for many generations it wasn't spoken about. But today, it's really in the forefront, and there's a hunt for talent out there. And if organizations want to attract and retain talent, they need to eliminate bias in their hiring process. And candidates need to be educated on how to fight it so they could end up working in the right company, in the right organization where they could flourish.
Maureen McKinney talking with career advisor Stacy Haller about age bias in the hiring process. Many Ukrainian Americans in Chicago are worried about what Donald Trump's return to the White House could mean for their home country. Anna Savchenko has more.
Marta Farian is with the Ukrainian Congress Committee of America. She says Ukrainians fear Trump's win may mean a reduction in U.S. aid to Ukraine. There's also concern about statements Trump made about settling the war between Russia and Ukraine.
Now the question is, at what price for Ukraine? So Ukrainian Americans are worried that Ukraine will be forced into a deal that will compromise Ukraine's independence and territorial integrity. But Ukrainians will not accept capitulation.
Farian hopes Republican lawmakers will work with the Trump administration to offer Ukraine security assurances. On the Savchenko, WBEZ News.
Rural homelessness is a growing issue nationwide, and in central Illinois, most counties don't have the social services infrastructure to support people in need. Several counties don't have homeless shelters. Agencies say there is a growing need to build them as the homeless population continues to climb. In the meantime, staff are left to find Band-Aid solutions. Melissa Ellen spoke to the people on the front lines in the fight to end homelessness about how they make use of the little resources they have.
Livingston County is seeing an unprecedented rise in the number of people homeless or on the brink of it. Numbers hit a record high in recent months, with 30 people identified as homeless countywide. That includes men, women, and children. Deb Howard is the director of United Way in Livingston County. She says there aren't enough resources for people to get back on their feet.
This has kind of become like an epidemic, where we definitely need something. I don't know what the answer is, but we need something.
Part of the problem is that Livingston County doesn't have a homeless shelter. Neither do most of the rural counties in the region, and it's becoming a strain on their already limited resources to find innovative ways to help people without them. Howard says Livingston County used to have no trouble sending people to other counties if a homeless shelter was needed.
And now we are, because they have their own issues.
Bloomington's two shelters have been full for months. Matt Burgess is the CEO of Home Sweet Home Ministries, which operates the Mission Shelter. He says Bloomington is lucky to have the homeless services network that it does. Most small cities and towns are like Pontiac, with few people able to support the homeless community.
The reality is there just aren't enough resources to have smaller shelters in all of the little towns in the rural area. It's just such a costly way of trying to provide support to people.
Caroline McLeese with Salvation Army Pontiac 360 Life Center says it may be the best option right now. She's starting to keep close track of the people in Livingston County who are homeless in the hopes of generating convincing data for people who are skeptical that rural homelessness exists in the area.
Nobody keeps track of these people, and that's my goal. I'm starting to keep track. I want to report this. I want to let everybody know this is what's going on. This is what we need help with. And I'm just hoping out of that, somebody's going to say, I'll help you.
The hum in the background is a refrigerator. I met with McLeese and the director of operations for Pontiac Salvation Army in the food pantry. They were short-staffed that day and had to help people in the pantry and the attached shop while we spoke. Director Tina Hammer says she and McLeese both want a shelter in Pontiac, but getting one won't be easy.
even if we were able to secure a shelter today, it would probably be a three-year plan before something was able to house anyone, which is a sad process between getting the funding and getting the building and getting the staff and everything else.
In the meantime, McLeese says the situation is bleak. Many homeless people find temporary housing with friends and family or in local motels that allow for long stays. If neither of those work out, there are Airbnbs. McLeese says these are typically outside people's budgets at around $600 per month, and even Salvation Army struggles to fund the people staying in them. But they make it work because the only other option is for people to live on the streets.
I don't think a lot of this community who has not experienced this realizes just how truly bad it is and that something has to be done about it.
There are several reasons why people are increasingly becoming precariously housed, and it's not an issue isolated to Pontiac or Central Illinois. Deb Howard with Livingston County United Way says the bottom line is that the cost of living is too high. It's gotten to the point where employed people can't pay their bills.
We have working people that are living in cars that hold jobs.
Howard says these people fall outside the income threshold for most federal aid programs. Permanent supportive housing is also not available. Howard says affordable housing is part of the solution, but it takes years to build and millions to fund.
How long can we put people up in hotels when there's no housing here? You know, it's almost like Band-Aids on everything. It's putting fires out and sticking Band-Aids on everything and no fix.
Several other counties surrounding Bloomington Normal are in the same boat as Livingston County. There are a handful of staff at a handful of agencies working to find temporary solutions to rural homelessness. Rachel Oney is one of two case managers at the Salvation Army 360 Life Center in Lincoln, which oversees eight rural counties. None have shelters, and the closest ones are in bigger cities, 45 minutes away.
Springfield, Champaign, Decatur, Pekin, Peoria. Any direction, we're like, pick a point and you can find a big city.
Oney says the best way area service providers have found to help people who are homeless within those counties is to collaborate. She works closely with the Community Action Partnership of Central Illinois to figure out how each organization can fill in the gaps left by the other's funding limitations.
There's no reason that you should have to go to three different agencies to find what you are looking for. If we all know what each other are doing, then we can connect people a lot faster.
This type of collaboration also helps the organizations better combat additional rural challenges, such as a lack of transportation. It's also led to an exciting possibility for Lincoln, getting its first homeless shelter. A nonprofit is hoping to get building renovations done on the shelter in the next 3 months. At that point, it can start opening up beds to unsheltered people throughout Logan County and its neighbors. Kim Turner chairs the board of the nonprofit. She says it will work with the Salvation Army and others to coordinate wraparound services, because having a shelter is only a first step.
Obviously, having a roof over your head is extremely important, but it's not everything. It doesn't fix all of your problems. So we want to be able to address those problems for overall stability.
Brandy Gerber in Woodford County knows firsthand how hard it can be to strike that balance. She works at the county's only homeless shelter called Heart House. It has 6 rooms for women and children only. She says they don't serve men because there are women fleeing domestic violence who stay there. They do serve men, though, at Heartline, which is their financial assistance arm. Gerber says there need to be more agencies offering help.
Is there enough resources for the homeless population in Woodford County? And I'm going to say no. And it's not just a service providing shelter, it's other supportive services.
Gerber says Woodford County has to rely on Peoria often, including for mental health and public aid opportunities, since Woodford County lacks both. Peoria is about 20 miles away from Eureka, the Woodford County seat. Gerber says she understands that bigger communities such as Bloomington Normal and Peoria have more people who are homeless, but it makes the rural places like Eureka less appealing for funding.
If I presented a grant for public transportation, and Peoria submitted a grant for public transportation, who would win that? It would be Peoria, because they're able to show more numbers of people that would be utilizing those services.
Gerber says getting public transportation is critical for getting people better connected to services in Woodford County, but it feels like a dream, just like Salvation Army staff in Livingston feel about getting a shelter. Matt Burgess at Home Sweet Home Ministry Shelter in Bloomington says it's up to each community to find what works for them.
One of the things that my experience has taught me is that when a community really has a will to accomplish something, they find ways to make it happen. It might not look like it does in other communities, but solutions start to rise to the surface that maybe weren't recognized before.
And agencies agree the need for solutions is clearer than ever before. They just have to get the right people on board. I'm Melissa Ellen.
Stay right here. More to come on Statewide. We'll talk about another step forward in the rise of women's sports. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. It was a successful year for women's sports. The WNBA Women's Basketball League captured more fans, along with women's soccer, hockey, and more. And it's also led to the opening of women's sports bars. It started with the Sports Bra in Portland, then a bar of their own in Minneapolis. Now bars catering to women's sports fans are popping up all over. Sasha Ann Simons talked with Nora McConnell-Johnson, owner of the future Babes Sports Bar, and Heather Roberts, co-owner of the now-open Whiskey Girl Tavern, both in Chicago.
I wonder, and I'd love to hear from both of you, why you think it took us so long to get that first dedicated women's sports bar that I mentioned in Portland. You first, Nora.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is such a relationship between this whole sort of ecosystem around women's sports. So the teams, the culture, the fans, the environment, the places to watch. And I think there it's all related. So I think it's like layered to the answer. But it's hard to find women's sports on TV, period, is sort of the first answer.
Right.
The streaming is really difficult. I'm sure Heather can talk about the challenges that they've faced at Whiskey Girl Tavern, even just putting the games on the TV. So I think that in itself like created a bit of a barrier. And then, of course, there's so much out there about like women-owned businesses, how hard it is for women to get small business loans. I think that what Jenny did in the sports bra in Portland, and like a fun fact is I went to college in Portland. Jenny worked at the college I went to, so it's like a fun little weird overlap. But Jenny really, I think, had this really breakthrough idea that to me, and I'm sure to Heather, like sounds so obvious when you think about it, but it is a innovation in what we're used to in terms of the environments we can seek out and the like what's available to us as consumers and fans of women's sports. Mm-hmm. So I think it took a while because it really is something that we had to like fight against sort of the systems to create.
Complicated, lots of layers as you laid out. What are your thoughts, Heather?
I agree with all those things. I think in general, there just aren't a lot of sports bars owned by women. And I think that women are the primary consumer still of women's sports. And, you know, again, the availability of broadcasting. And I think the demand has just increased so much that it allows for the constant programming, you know, versus there'd be popular events here and there, but it wasn't enough to sustain a business previously.
So how does it feel then to be part of what's now a growing movement?
We're really proud of what we've created. I think we a little bit lucked into the timing of all of it because we've had this business plan since 2018. We opened in July of 22, and we always were planning to show women's sports because my wife and I are big sports fans. But, you know, it kind of coincided pretty much exactly with when we opened and when the viewership really took off. So we've been really blessed to have such a great fan base, to have established a really strong community that loves to watch sports at our establishment. And, you know, it's been really amazing just the reception we've received.
Yeah.
I've watched many a game at Whiskey Girl Tavern.
Yes, very good. And that means it's working,
yeah.
Right? And just getting back to the feeling, you brought me back to a place, just thinking about the times that I've been at bars and actually asked for a Sky game or asked for, this is when I lived in D.C., I would ask all the time for like the women's soccer games and kind of getting sometimes met with pushback, you know, like, oh, nobody really wants to watch that right now. So I just want to hear from you what it's felt like not having spaces where you were able to watch your favorite sports team or just have that community, Nora.
Yeah, I have gotten more. Lately, I've gotten better reception from sort of bartenders or folks at bars to put on games. So that at least is like, it does feel like there is a bit of a shift in that.
Mm-hmm.
I will say, though, that I mean, I was just watching game two of the WNBA series, the finals, at a bar, a men's sort of sports bar. And the bartender, really nice about it, found a TV, put the audio on. I was really into that.
Right.
And then some guys came in, sat down the bar for me, and I could like sense and hear what they were saying about the fact that the women's sports were on while they were trying to watch football. And like, I think what Babes
even
is,
this year,
yeah,
this season,
was
when it was so
ago.
Hot.
Yeah.
Right?
And I think what Whiskey Girl Tavern does, what Babes plans to do, is to not just prioritize having those on the TV, but also creating a space where, like, fans of women's sports don't have to prove that they are worth being on the TVs, that it's really, like, what is celebrated and what is expected.
Yeah. So we'll talk more about what Whiskey Girl's been doing, but first I want to get into your plans a bit with Babe's Sports Bar at 3017 West Armitage. This is coming next year, Nora. Tell us how the journey started.
Yeah, I mean, I honestly, so I work in education. I have not worked behind a bar yet, but I have always been a really big women's sports, both like advocate and also player. I've played women's sports and team sports my whole life. I was the captain of the boys soccer team in high school because I went to a small high school, and okay. So I like firsthand got to see sort of what it, like, my team really respected me, but playing other schools and experiencing what some boys who like couldn't handle that felt like was really eye-opening for me as a young person. And then in college, women's sports was really a through line and sort of the community that came with my team, my rugby team in college. My co-owner, Tora, she and I were co-captains of the rugby team in college, and we really sort of got our start like in the weeds there. We led a Title IX case against our college and the athletic director for like long time discrimination against the women's sports teams.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and it was just this very eye-opening moment for me as a young person of like how these institutions don't support women athletes and how important being a woman athlete has been to me my whole life. And so I like already was sort of positioned in this like it's not right out there.
Yeah. Though you don't market yourselves as a sports bar, Whiskey Girl is definitely a destination for women sports fans in this city. So talk about how that and your neighborhood has treated you.
Yeah, we're definitely a community bar. So that's kind of our focus is to really have the bar mirror the community that we were in. We've had an amazing reception. We actually replaced a pool hall that was in our space.
Oh, really? Yeah. Tell us more about the start.
So our plan back in 2018 when we started all this was to buy an existing space, very small, and take over, something so it was simple. We could, have to reuse the license without starting from scratch. When COVID happened, we kind of backed out of that. 2 years later, our friend called us up who owned the building and said, hey, the space that's in there is moving. We'd like you to go in and open something. So we went from, probably a 1,200 square foot space to a 5,000 square foot space.
Wow. Yeah, so speaking of design and thinking about the space, Nora, you've got a specific design philosophy in mind as well for Babes.
Yeah, we're going for, I call it like vintage varsity vibe. We're going for sort of, I've been living in this sort of like futurism state lately, thinking about like what if women's sports had been on a path to be as respected and cherished as men's sports are in our society? Like what would a bar for women's sports look like in that instance? And so I think we're taking over what was a dive bar, and so we get to really sort of rip it down and make it ours with a good foundation. We're working with Siren Betty, who's a women-owned design firm that has done a lot of beautiful spaces that I love in the city, and we are working with them to really think both about the aesthetic of the space, like how do we like make it a beautiful space that really shows how these sports, watching them is a really valuable thing and should be like done nice in a nice way, but also thinking about like the actual design of the sort of structure and the way that we are like designing it for our audience. So thinking about the ways that bars have been like hostile or designed without women in mind, we're working to like make sure we're incorporating those pieces. So just like lowering the bar top, it's so high right now, making sure that the seats are ergonomically designed specifically for more traditionally women bodies. We're like really trying to think about how the design of the whole space can really facilitate that.
And both of your spaces, really good programming, fun programming at Whiskey Girl. So I know that you've got lots of plans in store too, but I mean, leave us with this, both of you. What do you think is the future of women's sports in Chicago? You first, Heather.
I think we've seen, I mean, Chicago's lucky because we've had strong women's sports programs for years. Both of our professional, the soccer and basketball, were founding members of these leagues. But I think there's just only room to grow. I think we've seen new ownership in a lot of these teams. We've seen a lot more investment. So I think as both Chicago and nationally, as the teams get more investment, the players get more resources, the quality of the play always goes up with that investment. The desire for players to play in these cities will improve. And so the product, even though it's great now, it's just going to keep getting better.
It's only up from here.
And it's going to keep attracting more and more fans.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, we're watching this explosion, Nora, of the WNBA and the National Women's Soccer League. It just popularity just going through the roof. Mm-hmm. What do you think is happening here?
Totally. I mean, I think Chicago, just like was said, I think Chicago has the capacity to be the hub for women's sports in the country. We're about to get a professional women's rugby team too, one of the first in the country. I do think that the rebranding of the Red Stars just happened, and it's like a show's real investment in making right. that team a real mark on our map, the Sky and the new practice facility. I would love to see the men's sports teams take some interest and support in this. I think that getting support from the Bulls, getting support from the Blackhawks of Fire would be awesome.
That'd be key.
Would show that they are committed to this also being a hub for all sports. But yeah, I think there's so much infrastructure here. There's so much talent. I'm a Sky season ticket holder. I mean, that team is incredible. So yeah,
I'm loving the momentum.
Yeah.
Let's keep it going,
only
right?
Only up, yeah.
We've been talking with Heather Roberts, who's co-owner of Whiskey Girl Tavern in Edgewater, and Nora McConnell Johnson, who is working to open Babe Sports Bar in Logan Square. Thank you both so much.
Thanks for having us.
Illinois lawmakers introduce thousands of bills each year. Sometimes one of them seems really popular. People flood the Capitol in support, chanting and carrying signs. Lawmakers hash it out with each other and meet with constituents. And it also gets a lot of media coverage. But even if the momentum seems there, sometimes the bill just dies, for any number of reasons. State House reporter Alex Degman gives us one example of how a bill moves and sometimes doesn't.
Invest in Kids was a way for parents to send their children to private schools, but it was ending. Here's how it worked. Illinoisans would donate money to organizations that offer scholarships, like Empower Illinois or the Big Shoulders Fund. In return, the state would offer them a 75% credit on their state income tax return, up to $7,500. Republican State Representative Blaine Wilhauer calls himself an education choice kind of guy. He wanted to see an extension.
We need to stop focusing so much on how much money we're spending and what the outcome of these students are. And the outcome is abysmal, so that's why they need more opportunity.
He wasn't alone in that. Private school students and their parents flooded the state capitol, at times flirting with the fire code maximum. They sometimes chanted so loudly in the rotunda that legislators had to stop talking on the floor whenever someone opened the door. All Republicans wanted the program extended. Some Democrats wanted that too, but they wanted a few tweaks, only a temporary extension, a smaller tax credit. Governor J.B. Pritzker campaigned on ending the program, but even he changed his tune.
I have said all along that if that's what happens, I will sign that bill. If they decide not to, that's also up to the General Assembly at this point. But I will say that a lot of consideration has been given.
But then the program wasn't extended. Wilhauer knew who to blame when that effort died.
The only reason that this doesn't get done, Alex, is because there are very, very powerful special interest groups that don't want it to happen. You know, the Chicago Teachers Union, the Illinois Education Association.
That may sound incendiary, but in this case, that's basically what happened. Dan Montgomery is the head of the Illinois Federation of Teachers.
Public dollars for the education of all our students should not go to private interests.
Groups like the IFT, or as Wilhauer calls them, special interest groups, are constantly trying to pass or kill legislation, but they often take a different approach. Instead of flooding the Capitol, Montgomery says their coalition spent months talking with lawmakers. He calls those massive demonstrations filled with signs and chanting astroturf operations. That's where something seems like it's a grassroots effort, but it's really paid for by, you guessed it, special interests.
I thought it was despicable. They took black and brown kids out of school down to Springfield, you know, and you could see sort of the white purveyors of this scheme holding them up as props.
All this back and forth is part of lobbying, and it's a key component of why legislation sometimes fails. Chris Mooney retired from teaching political science in the University of Illinois system. He says lawmakers listen to lobbyists. A lot.
For the vast majority of legislation, they're just there to hear what the lobbyists have to say. They're not nefarious. They're part of the process. They're part of the information process.
And there are plenty of opportunities for lawmakers to talk to lobbyists. The spring session runs from January through May. That's plenty of time for a bill to get held up at one of several choke points like the House Rules or the Senate Assignments Committees.
There's a million ways to kill a bill, and only one very careful way, you got to walk through this process step by step, minefields to pass it.
In the end, a bill to extend Invest in Kids needed 71 yes votes. Even with all 40 House Republicans ready to vote yes and a few Democrats supposedly on board, House Speaker Emanuel Chris Welch told reporters he didn't think that was enough, so he didn't call it. The scholarship program known as Invest in Kids was officially dead. I'm Alex Degman.
State lawmakers returning to Springfield this weekend for the start of the lame duck session. That's all the time we have for this episode of Statewide. Thanks for being along with us. Remember, you can listen to all of our episodes. They're available where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois next week. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois public radio stations.